parties are ready to proceed, please do so.
May it please the court, Joel Henriot on behalf of the appellants, FGA Inc., doing business as the defendant restaurant, Carmine's Little Italy, and on behalf of the landlord, the Carmine and Ann M. Vento Revocable Trust. In this case, the district court made several rulings, in particular rulings that effectively took the issue of causation and damages from the jury and significantly hobbled defendant's ability to defend against the prima facie element of liability. There are a number of issues. I think that they are set out in the briefing, well, both on in the answering brief and in appellant's briefing. So I'll just brush through the issues in general, unless in the interest of time the court has any specific questions on particular issues where you'd like us to focus. First on damages. This is a case where plaintiff fell in a restaurant and then alleged that that fall by itself caused $400,000 in past medical expenses and an additional $2.9 million in future medical expenses. We know and that it caused three discs to be removed from her spine, the requirement for three discs to be removed from her spine. We know that before the fall, she had had for many, many years a symptomatic, a severe to moderate symptomatic problem in her back, upper and lower, that caused the need for prescription pain medication, a constant stream of prescription pain medication for at least 8 years. In the months before the fall, she had been meeting with her physician, Dr. Kidwell, to pursue more aggressive treatment. None of that was ever submitted to the jury. And the jury was left with the impression, expressly given by plaintiff's medical experts and by plaintiff's counsel, that until the day of this fall, her conditions in the back, if any, were normal, ordinary, age-related, and that all of her symptoms began on the day of this fall. That's just false. Now, one of the things that I think the answering brief, respondent's answering brief, does very well is set out the rationale that Judge Williams relied on in excluding all of that evidence. I think that it is a misinterpretation of Morsicato. Essentially, what Judge Williams says is that after the fall, there was diagnostic testing that gives us a sure knowledge that she had problems with her discs. We have nerve root blocks, we have discographies, we have ironclad proof that that is the particular diagnosis after the fall. Before the fall, we have no similar diagnosis that would have made her a surgical candidate for the surgery she had after. So he thought that there was no foundation upon which an expert could say to a reasonable degree of medical probability that we know she had the exact same diagnosis before that she had after. Even though the doctors generally disagreed that this was irrelevant.
Oh, in the briefings done here, it was before Williams.
It
but
was.
But even under Williams, looking at the record here, it seems like it's still inadmissible. The focus pre-accident was on facet problems that created this pain. And so what would be your argument under Williams, supported by the record, that would connect the alternative cause to disc pre-injury?
Under Williams, the test for the defendant in putting forward an alternative cause is that it be plausible. Not that it be probable, but that it be plausible. And that that be established that it is relevant and supported by competent medical evidence. Here, the reason that there is some treatment before the fall on facets is because she had gone in to Dr. Kidwell and say, I have this severe pain. She had been taking prescription medications for a long time, and he said, well, let's try to get to the bottom of exactly what it is. And he started with facets. And he was able to ascertain that the facets were a primary generator of the pain. But after he had treated the facets, 3 days after he had treated the facets, 70% of her pain still lingered, which led him then to recommend a selective nerve root block that would have affirmatively ruled in disc pain. And she fell shortly before that happened. But what's clear is that something was causing her pain beyond her facets. And that is why the physician who actually performed the surgery, Dr. Capes, who typically testifies on behalf of patients who he treats when they are plaintiffs, said that he did not think it was possible to draw a causal link. He did not think it was possible to draw a causal link between the slip and fall at the restaurant, or the fall, we don't know if it was a slip or a trip, between the fall at the restaurant and the surgeries that he performed, because she had such a severe symptomatic problem beforehand that appeared to him to be more than possessive, that it was chronic, that it was symptomatic, that it was long-lasting. And he thought that that prevented any causal link being drawn between the two. So we have Dr. Cabins, who is plaintiff's treating physician, that in that sense is vouching for the expert testimony of Dr. Surfistini, who looked at the 11-year history and said, given the chronic and severe pain that we have all along, and the fact that the facets did not completely ameliorate her pain when they were treated for more than a few days, that it is impossible to draw this causal link between the slip and fall and three discs having to be removed as a result of the fall at the restaurant.
I could be mistaken, but I don't read Surfistini's testimony as offering a connection to the discs. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think what he's doing is he is saying that there is a degenerative condition in the discs, that the record does show a degenerative condition in the discs that is symptomatic, that would cloud any causal link being drawn between the fall and the disc injury. That it is impossible, given how severe and long the same symptoms were before, draw a link just between the discs and the fall. Merely because we don't have ironclad diagnostic tools before the fall. And I think Dr. Poindexter is on that same page. I think Dr. Cabins is on the same page. And then even Dr. Oliveri, who ended up testifying, was saying that apportionment was appropriate. But Dr. Kidwell, who said, yes, facets, I'm ruling in facets, is the same one who says, but that's not solving the problem. It's helping, but it's not solving the problem, which is why I want you to go and have selective nerve root blocks that will tell me whether or not the discs are also an issue.
Counsel, you have some other arguments that may also be important. I don't want to short this argument, but your time is getting away. Do you wish to comment on those other issues?
Thank you, and if I could reserve at least 3 minutes. I think on
the
liability.
I ask you why the mode of operation instruction should be extended beyond in-service restaurants. I know you argue it should not. It's an error.
Right.
But there is some policy reasons for doing so, for giving such an instruction in this case, isn't there?
I think there may be. The problem is that in drawing a definition that would include a situation like this, you essentially have an exception that swallows the rule. If the definition is expanded to a situation where the only evidence of a continuous nature is that it's not unusual for food to fall, well, then you have now drawn a line that would include all restaurants. But while I think that is error, I think the real prejudicial effect came in with a combination of various rulings here. As we argue in the brief, mode of operation doesn't apply because it isn't self-serve and because I think there's not a threshold showing of a virtually continuous danger. But the problem is that it was an abuse of discretion after the court had allowed that theory to go forward to still preclude us from bringing in the history of this restaurant, that no one had fallen here before. The reason that the court excluded the fact that no one had fallen before was under El Dorado Club versus Graff. The idea that this foreign substance on the floor was temporary. And when the substance is temporary, then you don't consider everything that's happened before because it's irrelevant. But the underlying theory for mode of operation, whether it is in the self-serve context more traditionally, or even under the cases that plaintiff cites that would expand it beyond self-serve, is that the conditions that lend themselves to the temporary dangerous circumstances are permanent. For instance, in Ruiz v. Toys R Us, Toys R Us was not entitled to summary judgment when someone slipped on a puddle of water in the store underneath a leaky roof. And the reason for that was that even though the store didn't have notice that there was a puddle on the floor on this particular day, what the store did have notice of was that they had a leaky roof problem that lent itself to puddles on the floor whenever it was raining. And in that sense, the history was relevant. Here, the district court let plaintiff have it both ways. The history doesn't come in because it's temporary, but they're absolved of their showing of their burden to show notice because it is a permanent dangerous condition which lends itself to spills. And if that was the basis to allow this to go forward to the jury on mode of operation, then very few things are more probative of whether or not this ongoing situation is actually dangerous than whether or not something has fallen in the past. And here, where the restaurant had been open almost 14 months and no one had fallen before. On the gaming regulations, again, giving it to plaintiff both ways. The district court should have stricken this ambush testimony, this ambush evidence about gaming regulations that were violated that did not even apply. But after those came in, it was an abuse of discretion to curtail our ability to submit to the jury in rebuttal the definitive proof from the Gaming Commission that we had a restricted gaming license, which made this inapplicable.
Was that based upon defendant's indication or testimony that original testimony that the regulations would apply to?
What happened is Frank Vento, who is the son, was on the stand and was asked whether or not this was restricted or unrestricted. He said he didn't know. He said he was assuming. He said that he assumed that it was unrestricted. But then we got this admission and the request to take judicial notice of the gaming regulations, which had never been disclosed. And restricted versus unrestricted was never at issue at any time during the motion.
Isn't that the basis of the, that would have to be the basis of the ruling, I would think.
Well, I think that would have to be the basis for the reason that he did not strike the testimony and the allegations regarding the gaming regulations. But after he'd allowed those to come in on a surprise basis because they were never raised at any time during...
Wasn't there a 16.1 disclosure?
There was not a 16.1 disclosure of the gaming regulations or that they would be an issue. And the issue of restricted versus unrestricted licensure never came up in discovery, in depositions. Auditing, a vague reference to auditing by the Gaming Commission came up, but there was no reference to restricted versus unrestricted.
Before you sit down, and Justice Hardesty may have some follow-up that's related to what we're talking about right now, I'd like you to briefly touch on the liability of the trust.
We have now in the answering brief an argument that we never saw at any time during trial or even post-judgment motions. Before, the liability of the trust wasn't argued at trial. Post-trial, it was argued that there should be alter ego theory applied, but without any analysis. Now what we see only in the answering brief is that they should be joint and severally liable because they helped design the restaurant. This is an issue that has been raised for the first time on appeal. It's nothing that the jury ever considered. And if the jury is not the one to assess that liability, then it should not be found in analysis that is presented for the first time to this court.
Thank you, Justice Douglas. Returning to the gaming regulation ruling, if it was error, how was it prejudicial? How was that used in the trial by the plaintiff?
The insinuation that the law required us to maintain operable surveillance equipment allowed plaintiff to suggest that either Carmine's Little Italy is a lawbreaker or they are a spoliator of evidence, one of those two, because they had to have it. So either they are lying to you that they didn't, or they are lying to the Gaming Control Board that all of this equipment is operable. And in a case where the jury found by a 51-49% margin that we were more liable, it is difficult to say that that is not prejudicial. Now, Mr. Carmine Vento was allowed one question in response to be able to clarify, to say, yes, I'm telling you it was a restricted license. But even at that, plaintiff's counsel argued in closing arguments, but where are the documents? How do we know what it is? No one's ever disclosed the license. So here, in rebuttal on an issue that had come up for the first time during trial, we asked the court to allow us to submit documentary evidence. That report, the one-page report from the Gaming Control Board, that we could say, this does not apply. And that was used against us as a shield and a sword in closing argument to say, well, we have a conflict of testimony between the son who says one thing, the father who says another, and where's the license? We don't know what that is. That is an issue that could have been resolved, and fairness required that we be allowed to resolve it, especially when it was raised for the first time in trial.
Yeah, I do have one more question, perhaps you can extend a little extra time for him since we chewed up his time. Can you comment just a little bit on the exclusion of the evidence that she had been drinking? What was the basis for the judge excluding that? Did he come out and say it was irrelevant in this particular situation?
I think that he thought that there was insufficient foundation to say that it was relevant. I think that there are two aspects to the whole issue. One is her consumption. And then the other is the consumption of her dinner companion, who was her only corroborating witness. Plaintiffs don't dispute anywhere in their brief that the facts, that between the two of them, they had six drinks. They don't dispute our legal authorities that say this is within the province of lay people, both jurors and witnesses, to assess the effects of intoxication and to consider how intoxication may affect someone's ability to perceive and recall, all of which was at issue. What they do is they point to the motions in limine and say that, well, maybe this was invited error because we had moved to exclude this. But I think it's clear from the motion in limine, from our opposition to their motion, from the reply and from the hearing, that what we were saying is that this is not the province in this case on this record for expert testimony. And I think that that's actually what the district court's, misconception was, is the notion that if there isn't sufficient foundation for expert testimony, then there's no reason why lay witnesses would be able to testify. And that just doesn't follow. I think that there are several reasons why the court is wary about experts, because the courts give them the imprimatur of authority, the stature of expert, and it can be intellectually intimidating on the jury, and it can softly invade the province of the jury, which is why we don't allow experts who won't be helpful to testify. And here we had an issue where the experts could not have added anything more than what the lay people could testify to. But I think the district court confused the required foundation for additional expert testimony versus the relevance that would make it proper for lay testimony. And here, we had significant consumption by both parties within the course of an hour, and we had that was undisputed. That was proper for the lay witnesses and the lay jurors to assess.
As far as causation is concerned, didn't you also have witnesses that would testify that they smelled alcohol and noticed slurred speech?
Yes. Yes. In addition, and that would have, I think, corroborated by the fact that we had this undisputed receipt that the two of them had consumed six drinks within an hour. So I don't think that the fact that Mr. Vento was able to smell a little bit of alcohol, if I understand where Your Honor is going, I don't think the fact that Mr. Vento was able to smell beer on her and that he perceived that she was wobbly or gave typical signs of intoxication makes the exclusion of the alcohol alcohol evidence irrelevant or redundant. Especially where, as plaintiffs argued at trial, well, of course she had the smell of alcohol because she had a drink, but that's not enough to say that she was intoxicated, and she may have seemed intoxicated because she had just hit her head. But that only goes to her. Her story was corroborated. The only other person who saw anything on that floor was her dinner companion, who said that he saw a spill the size of a quarter several feet away, that he could detect that it was an oily substance, and that he's the one who saw that after having four drinks himself in the course of an hour. So I think there is the issue as to her, but then there is the issue as to him as a corroborating witness. And I don't think that is resolved by the fact that Mr. Vento smelled alcohol on her breath.
Thank you. We will give you your 3 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you.
Taking up time. Mr. Wall will give you some additional time if you need it.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, good morning. David Wall on behalf of the plaintiff in this case. With the court's permission, I'll begin where Mr. Henriot left off on this issue of intoxication. First of all, as I know this court knows, the beginning of any of our arguments such as this is to determine the standard of review. And for the admission or failure to admit certain evidence, the standard, of course, is abuse of discretion. But I think it's important to note the sequence of events that occurred when Judge Williams made the decision he did on the issue of intoxication, in fact, on all of these. You have the slip and fall. You have the defendant company incident report filled out by representative of the company, which say nothing about intoxication. You have years later a deposition of Frank Vento, a principal in the defendant business, saying, well, you know, I think I did smell alcohol, or her speech was somewhat slurred. And then you have a human factors expert hired on behalf of the defense that says, you know, you have to take into account in any human factors of a slip and fall the condition of the person who fell, without more. In his deposition, when questioned on that, he went a little further and said, well, having a few drinks is a condition that you have to take into account. So it became apparent that the defense was going to be somehow that intoxication played a role. And so the plaintiff hired an expert to rebut that human factors expert, a physician to review the medical records, the EMT records, and any evidence on the issue of intoxication and impairment. And he came to the conclusion that there was zero evidence of intoxication, of impairment, and that it would be required, if not customary, for the EMTs who responded to the scene and the emergency room where she was taken to have noted it if it existed. So what happened next was motions in limine. And based on the evidence there was, the plaintiff filed a motion in limine to preclude any evidence of intoxication under Holderer and the other cases on point. What's noteworthy is that the defense also filed a motion in limine to keep out evidence of intoxication levels. That is, the expert saying, on behalf of the plaintiff, there is no evidence of intoxication or impairment. They moved to keep that out. So when presented with both of those, and I think it's important to note that the court saw it for what it was. But the defense wanted to raise an inference that there was alcohol or intoxication or impairment by having a witness say, gee, I smelled something. It smelled like alcohol. And there may have been slurred speech. I understand she fell and hit her head. But then preclude the actual scientific or medical evidence that shows there was no impairment. And here's what they said in their motion, the defense. Defense said in their motion to the district court that the doctor agreed at his deposition that obtaining a blood alcohol level is the standard or objective criteria for determining intoxication. And there was no blood alcohol level test here. And then they said this to the district court. As such, any testimony from the doctor or any other witness would be speculative in nature, would only serve to confuse and mislead the jury, and must be precluded. With a complete lack of foundation for such opinions, the doctor and all witnesses must be precluded from testifying regarding toxicology or intoxication levels. They affirmatively asked the trial court for that relief, and now they say it's error for the trial court to have kept out the information on intoxication only from Mr. Vento. They argue its probative value was stronger than the danger of unfair prejudice when they themselves say that the information is speculative. They want the speculative, foundationless inference to come in, but not the medical evidence which ultimately refuted it. And the trial court saw that for what it was, granted both motions, both the plaintiff's motion to prevent intoxication and the defendant's motion to preclude, obviously, the expert on it. And this is similar to what this court did in Holderer. Holderer, you'll recall, is the auto accident case where essentially a fault-free driver was indisputably under the influence of a prescription drug. I believe it was Alprazolam or Xanax. And what this court said not only was, look, the only evidence was that the other driver was at fault. But in that case, the defense wanted to raise the inference that, hey, there was Xanax in his system, therefore it could have affected his reaction times. He might have been able to avoid the accident, essentially. And what this court said, and I'm quoting, other than speculating that Holderer's reactive abilities could have been affected, the defendant never demonstrated that Holderer's prescription drug use was a contributing cause of the accident. There was a complete lack of further evidence establishing the extent of Holderer's alleged impairment or how the impairment caused or contributed to the accident. So admitting the evidence of Xanax was error. And that's exactly what we have here. There's no evidence that the defense had or ever presented to the trial court about how any alcohol would have impaired the plaintiff in any way, which makes it more prejudicial than probative. On the issue of the gaming regulations, it's important to understand how this evolved. And the evolution began with the revelation that the surveillance cameras either were not working or the video, which would have clearly shown the fall, was not preserved. Ultimately, it was one of the reasons that the court gave an adverse inference instruction to the jury, an instruction which is not challenged here. There were actually two reasons. There was the video, and there was the issue of the plaintiff's dress, which had been washed after the fact. It just laid out the law. It didn't specifically reference the video. It didn't specifically reference the dress. Now, during discovery, Frank Vento, who was designated by the defense as their 30B6, their person most knowledgeable on a number of topics on the business, including gaming regulations and surveillance, that's who they designated. And when he was deposed, he said that he understood that the defense, the Carmine's Little Lily, was in compliance with gaming regulations when it came to issues of surveillance cameras. He was called at trial, and at trial he testified, and it wasn't quite as confused, I think, as was presented to you. three times in a row, under questioning by his own counsel, the person most knowledgeable on gaming regulations said it was an unrestricted gaming license, which triggers those gaming regulations. At a hearing outside the presence after his testimony, the defense requested, and the trial court allowed, Carmine Vento, his father, and actually the trustee of the trust and the sole shareholder of the corporation, to testify that it was actually a restricted license, and so these regulations might not apply. The court granted that request, and Carmine Vento testified as such. And when they claim to this court that there is prejudice, it's important to note that the trial court asked the defense, do you want to propose a jury instruction telling the jury that it's a restricted license? Gave them that opportunity to correct any error that they perceived, to take corrective action, even gave them a recess to consider that. And their response was, no, we don't want an offer an instruction. And what they said to the court was, and I quote, we agree that the testimony, and this would be as to whether it's restricted or unrestricted, as read right now seems to have a conflict in it. But I think it's very clear. I don't think the jury is going to be confused or concerned about that issue. So we won't be proposing an instruction to Your Honor on that point. So their PMK testifies at trial, it's unrestricted, which would make the regulations admissible and relevant. And then his father, who actually was the PMK of the trust, I believe, at least one of the other entities, is allowed over the plaintiff's objection to say that it's a restricted license. And but then they forego specifically the right to
have. If I can interrupt you one second. The whole essence of this is, if it's an unrestricted license, the gaming regulations don't apply as far as the video is concerned.
Actually, if it's a restricted license.
Or if it's a restricted, yes.
Right.
And so that's the crux of this. But yet allowing the introduction of the gaming regulations pertaining to an unrestricted license, it seems.
Well, when their person most knowledgeable testifies under oath that it is an unrestricted gaming license, then it becomes relevant. There was a conflict of testimony, but unlike the ordinary conflict in testimony, it's not from defendant's witness and plaintiff's witness. It's from defendant's person's most knowledgeable.
But there's an issue there and a problem with that. The proffer of documents that might clear it up later were objected to.
And they were given an opportunity to have the court at least consider a jury instruction on it being being a restricted license.
Right. And the jury instruction, though, in that regard, how much is that going to help in them linking up the issue with the video?
Oh, I think immensely.
Okay.
If there's a conflict in the testimony, if one of defendant's representatives says three times it's an unrestricted license, which would make the regulations apply, another, his father essentially, saying it's restricted, which means the regulations don't apply, and then an instruction from the court essentially resolving that conflict would go a long way. I'm a big proponent of the jury listening to what the court instructs them. But what they told the court was, it's really not something that we're that concerned with. It's not something that the jury's going to really care about. It is what they said in response to the court when the court asked them if they wanted an instruction. They denied, really, the trial court, I suppose, if it was error, to correct the error. And this court has spoken on many occasions about the duty, really, to let the trial court try to correct any perceived error. I mean, we get to Leoce, even, where if it's unobjected to comment, then it's got to be plain error. So I think by denying the court the opportunity to give the jury instruction, there's waiver here. In the few minutes I have left, I want to talk about the mode of operation.
Before you leave that point, if you could... the reason I asked about whether it was prejudicial, the gaming regulation issue, is that the adverse inference instruction was given because the video wasn't working. They had a video, it just wasn't working.
And that they got rid of the equipment afterwards.
So there was really this debate about the regulation and the confusion in the record. There would have been reason perhaps to give that instruction because the video didn't work and was found not to work.
Right. Right. And really they had a duty to ensure that it's working.
They had one.
Right.
So then the question is, if it's there, was it working or not?
Well, and there was a conflict in the testimony between the employees of Carmine's, Little Italy. Some had said they had checked it the day before and it was working. And I think Carmine Vento, I could be mistaken on this, but I think it was Carmine Vento who was the one who said it hadn't worked for years, or it hadn't worked for a long, long time, and no steps were taken to replace it. In fact, I think he's also the one who testified that even after this event, although it might be one of the other employees, they didn't replace it, and there was actually evidence that it hadn't been replaced for a year or two after this event occurred. So even with the recognition of what the regulations might be. I have to comment on this motive operation jury instruction. And I must confess that I think I do not see how there is even remotely any potential prejudice to this, even if the instruction might not have applied. And I'm certainly not conceding that, because I think under the way this business was set up,
assuming for a moment that instruction doesn't apply, why isn't that prejudicial to give it?
Because the only reason it wouldn't apply is if the court accepted that Sprague was the outer limit of such an instruction, that it has to be a self-service or customer type of source of the spill. In this case, the jury was instructed under clear Nevada law that if there's a foreign substance on the floor and an agent or employee of the defendant caused that spill to be on the floor, that's negligence, and the defendant business is liable. If someone else caused it to be on the floor, the business is liable if they had actual or constructive notice. And the jury was instructed on all of these principles.
Mr. Walden, that goes us to the point of the attempt to bring in notice or lack thereof.
So the motive operation jury instruction, you're exactly right, is sort of a component or corollary to the constructive notice requirement if someone else is responsible for being for that substance being on the floor. Here's the gist of it. There wasn't any evidence, and it wasn't even their position, that someone else other than an employee caused the substance to be on the floor. Their defense, from beginning to end, opening statement, expert witnesses, cross-examination of the plaintiff and her companion, closing argument, was that she tripped, that there was no substance on the floor. They never said, if there was a substance on the floor, we're not the ones who put it there, it would be a customer, and now you have to prove actual or constructive notice. If I may continue on.
Go ahead.
So, if the substance was there as a result of the defendants or their employees placing it there, mode of operation jury instruction doesn't matter, because constructive notice is no longer an issue. They are responsible if one of their employees put that substance on the floor that she slipped on. No one ever said, and no one ever from the defense presented even an argument that substance on the floor is not something, it must have been a customer. like a customer in Sprague or like a customer in JASCO or any of the other type cases. They're saying, oh, no, 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 hold this to self-service, and it was prejudicial to us. It was never part of their defense. They couldn't have been prejudiced by it because they never made the argument, hey, that substance on the floor was put there by someone else, not us. Now you have to prove constructive notice. They never made that argument. It was never their position. Their position was she tripped and fell over her own feet. And they had quite a bit of evidence that they presented to the jury to try to establish that. The manner in which she fell forward. Basically the gist of their human factors expert. So this jury instruction could only be prejudicial to them if somehow they alleged that a customer is the one who put the spill on the floor, and now our right to be protected by constructive notice is somehow abridged by this certain jury instruction. And that was never the case at trial. It was never the case at trial. It was never the case at any time during the litigation. And frankly, even if you take the next step forward, the way that this business was set up would allow for a motive of operation jury instruction, even if they had argued that it was a customer who spilled it on the floor. I mean, essentially what you had is right in front of the kitchen, there's a wall about 4 feet high, and that's where plates come out, and that's where servers finish with the plates, and it's all right there, and that's the area that they had people walk through to get to the restroom. That's the area that they directed customers to walk through to get to the restroom, customers of the restaurant. So the mode of operation would basically, under the same theory as Sprague, place them on constructive notice that there could be a spill there that someone would reach.
Mr. Well, before you sit down, Lisa, we'd give you some additional time.
Thank you.
In the opening, they talked about the issue of damages and prior. You want to comment on that?
I do. And there were, I'll try to be brief on it, but there were really two separate things. There was cervical neck issues and there was low back issues. And I think it's important for this court to understand just what the district court did. The trial court approached this, I will say frankly, in the manner in which you would encourage them to approach it. There were voluminous motions on the admissibility of this evidence. There were deposition transcripts and medical records and expert reports and meets and legal authorities. There was a prolonged motion hearing. This was part of a motion to, on behalf of the plaintiff, to exclude unrelated medical conditions. There were about a dozen, about 10 of which the defense agreed were unrelated. And then there were these two issues. After the argument, the court asked for supplemental briefing on the issue, more medical records, more deposition transcripts, more briefing, and came to the conclusion, based on a variety of circumstances, with respect to the neck, the evidence was that there was no treatment on her neck for a period of 3 years prior to the accident. About 6 months before the accident, there was one x-ray on her neck, but no accompanying record to say why it was done, whether there was a pain complaint or what. And with respect to the neck, This circumstance was so acute after the injury that within 2 months after the injury, she's undergone an entire workup, and that's when she has the fusion in her neck. Dr. Surfistini, their entire argument rests on Dr. Surfistini, and his conclusion essentially, certainly as viewed by the district court, was that, look, she had neck pain before. She had a surgery on her neck afterwards. They're related. It's important to note that in addition to the evidence that we propounded, the plaintiff propounded, as to why the circumstance of the neck was related to the fall, that the defense had another medical expert, Dr. Poindexter, who testified that the cervical fusion was causally related to the fall. More likely than not, the cervical injury was related to the fall. So their own expert determined that the neck was related to the fall. And the trial court determined in the gatekeeper role that even after Hallmark and Higgs and Morsicato and the Williams opinion, this court still places on a trial judge to say that there wasn't competent medical research accompanying Dr. Serfestini's conclusions. With respect to the low back, and if I may even be
go ahead.
With respect to the low back, the testimony was from Dr. Kidwell, who was the treating doctor before the fall, that he had isolated this as a facet injury, facet pain, prior to her falling. And that he did that to a reasonable degree of medical probability based on the MRIs, based on his physical exam, based on the way she responded to the treatment that he had provided to her. To sort of do this as quickly as I can, what the trial court had was clear evidence of no disc injury prior to the fall. Trial court had clear evidence of a 3-level disc injury after the fall. And the trial court had Dr. Poindexter, who was a defense expert, saying that there was no disc injury before the fall, no evidence of a disc injury before the fall. And again, you had Dr. Serfestini saying she had pain before, she had back pain after, I related. And what the trial court said, although Williams wasn't written, obviously, yet before this trial, the trial court here, Judge Williams, did exactly what this court, in the later opinion of Williams, asked him to do, and that's determine whether or not, whether you call it an alternative theory of causation or an expert to cross-examine the plaintiff's expert, to determine whether it's based on speculation and conjecture, whether it's relevant, and whether it's supported by competent medical research. And the trial court determined that there wasn't any evidence to support a conclusion that the prior lumbar low back treatment for an entirely different injury was related or relevant or admissible. Essentially what the trial court said, and I'm quoting Judge Williams, after spending time reviewing medical records in this case, this isn't just a back pain case. It's not a case involving facet injury, but diagnosed discogenic pathology. And that's the distinction this court has made as far as this case is concerned. And so that was the factual basis for the court's determination as to exclusion of those specific records. I mean, you can have leg pain, but there's many components to the leg. You've got the ankle, you've got the knee. It's very similar as far as the back is concerned in this case. So he reviewed everything, the hundreds if not thousands of pages, and came to a conclusion that basically is, frankly, is supported by Williams, the Williams decision of this court, even though it came out years later. Thank you.
Anything additional?
Yeah. Thank you.
Counsel.
In the abuse of discretion standard, I think that is technically the standard because these are evidentiary issues. But this case far exceeds whatever critical mass ought to be necessary to warrant this court's attention and correction on alcohol. While the motion that we originally submitted, the motion in limine, may have been inartful in exactly what we were asking be excluded, when you consider the opposition that we filed to the competing motion, the reply that we filed in support of our own, and the arguments made during the hearing, what we were asking for was clear, and that's only that the record did not support expert testimony. And even now, the defense that you hear of the district court's ruling on alcohol goes only to plaintiff's consumption. No one has ever mentioned or justified why we should not have been able to cross-examine the only corroborating witness on his four drinks within an hour.
Were the motions in limine specific or broad as to this issue?
The motion in limine itself that we submitted was broad. But we made clear at the hearing, we corrected that and clarified it and said what we were asking for, that it was that the experts weren't warranted, based just on a review of whether or not anyone had noted signs of intoxication in Ms. Julio after the fall. But again, even this doesn't mention Frank Schreffel and his four drinks. The gaming regulations, those did not come in because Frank Vento said that this was an unrestricted license. He said that three times after the gaming regulations had already come in. The plaintiffs asked for the court to take judicial notice of those before restricted versus unrestricted.
What about the issue of the jury instruction that was offered that
on the jury instruction, we were offered the opportunity to have a jury instruction tell the jury what the jury had already been told, and that is that the regulations require surveillance when it is an unrestricted license. But the problem is that we had been left with this fake conflict in the evidence about whether or not this actually was an unrestricted license. And it does us no good. It does not cure the prejudice to have the court say, well, if this is an unrestricted license, only then would the video surveillance equipment be required. But if we are not allowed to clarify for the jury with definitive document proof that this was a restricted license, then just having the court restate that law does us no good. May I have 1 minute?
Go ahead and sum up.
On the medical analysis, especially on the low back, the only evidence that this was merely a facet injury, this multi-year problem was only a facet injury, is Dr. Kidwell. I hate to burden this court, but you have the entirety of that deposition. He never says this was merely a facet problem. What he says was, I was trying to figure out what the problem was. We were working her up before she had this fall. I found that facets were a problem, but then I suggested further diagnosis because more was at issue. And that's why all of the doctors in this case, none of them will make the leap that the district court made to say that discs were not a problem before she fell. No one will say that.
Thank counsel for the fine arguments this morning. The matter will stand submitted. This court's in recess till 1:30.